Coming out this Saturday and Beyond the Vibe, we're taking a look at the next blues rock acts to watch out for. First up, I'm joined by Gary Kane, and then Ross Connor and James Ives of the Ramblin' Preachers.
I wore my UK beer shirt.
I was about to say that's. I know Newcastle Brown. I'm familiar. thanks for reaching out, by the way. I appreciate you dropping a line and that. You know,
it's. Yeah, man. Well, I've watched a few of your podcasts already, so I was kind of like, hey, man, this guy's kind of up my alley. So.
Well, thank you very much for reaching out and, you know, just considering me. It's always cool, you know, seeing new artists and whatnot. So I'm here with Gary Kane. Thank you very much for joining me.
Hey, great to be here, man. Good to meet you.
Of course, you know, I like to start things off by, you know, looking at how things all began for a musician. So what was kind of that beginning point for you? You know, what was that thing that made you think, you know, I want to be a musician and, you know, in particular, I want to be a guitarist. Did you have a moment?
Well, I mean, I started playing piano first early on. My mom taught me piano when I was like about 3 years old, just to keep me out of her hair when I was home with her. And so that was kind of my first introduction to music. And it was pretty cool just to be able to press keys and hear music come out. I'm sure it wasn't great at the beginning, but yeah, guitar wise, my mom had an acoustic guitar, an old classical guitar just sitting in the corner, and I started playing around with it. And I enjoyed that. But then I think the bolt of lightning really hit me when I first heard Angus Young of AC/DC. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I was like just blown away by that. Their live album, If You Want Blood, You've Got It, that album. When I was a kid, I just used to put the headphones on when I was walking to elementary school and just have that cranked. And yeah, it was amazing. I got to be a rock star on the way to and back from school. So that's kind of what lit the fuse for me, I think.
You know, I often ask that question of, you know, what was that first band or musician for you? Was that Angus when you were growing up?
Yeah, for sure. I was just obsessed with him when I was a kid, and I started learning all AC/DC's tunes. I was into the old stuff, Bon Scott era stuff. So like Highway to Hell and If You Want Blood, You Gotta were kind of my two favorite albums by them. And I was playing it all on a nylon string acoustic, which wasn't great. And then a friend of mine was also really into him, and he was a drummer. So I would tape a microphone to the acoustic and plug it into his parents' stereo system, which I'm sure was god-awful. But they let us jam out in his rehearsal room. So that's kind of how we got into that.
Can you remember that first gig that you went to? I often find that's usually quite a moment for somebody, you know, where they think, you know, this is great, but I kind of want to have that. Whatever this person's got, I want that. Did you have that kind of thing?
Yeah. I mean, it's nothing related to the genre I'm kind of the style I play now, but the first concert that we've gone to, there were two early on. One was Roger Whittaker, who I believe a South African guy. He would play acoustic guitar and whistle. And my parents took, I think we were in like fifth row too. We had good seats at the Memorial Auditorium in my hometown. And I was just blown away because it was so loud. When you go to a live show, it's loud it's not like listening to it at home on your stereo. So I was blown away by that, just the spectacle of it. And then the second show around that time too was Nana Mouskouri, who is like a crooning singer, I guess. I don't know if anybody's heard of her, but anyway, we saw her at a really big performance hall or concert hall. And it was the same thing where, like, the lights and the sound and she had a big flowing dress and everything was just, like, you know, blew me away. So I think when I saw that, I was just, it seemed like magic to me, you know, to see somebody perform like that. So.
Of course, you know, there'll be those out there that aren't familiar with you. So for those that aren't,
I know.
For those that aren't, you know, how would you describe your sound? You know, who is Gary Kane?
I had it described to me once, and I've used it ever since by somebody as 1 foot in the blues and 1 foot in everything else. And so it's kind of blues is kind of my first love. I think when I first got into AC/DC, those old albums, a lot of that is basically blues, but just kind of through a Marshall Stack, a lot of that stuff, like Ride On, some of those tunes. But so I really got into blues early on, blues and rock, and then I like funk, like fusion, twangy stuff, like country picking, and like old R&B and soul stuff too, gospel. So it's kind of just a big gumbo pot of all that stuff. And there's a lot of guitar, that's for sure.
I mean, I've been listening through your previous two albums and of course the one that's on the way. And, you know, obviously, you know, you have that kind of blues influence there, but there's other elements as well. You know, I'm hearing rock, I'm hearing funk, you know, that occasional bit of kind of country elements in there as well. Do you like that kind of, that freedom of not just kind of boxing yourself into, you know, I'm just going to be kind of traditional blues? Do you like kind of being able to go, you know what, I'm feeling this?
Yeah, I mean, for me, that's kind of what appeals to me about music is being able to have a freedom of expression. So, I mean, I love traditional blues. Like, Albert King's one of my favorite guitar players of all time. But for me, I can't really just do, like, sit on one kind of style for an entire evening of a gig or putting out an album. I like to kind of stretch out. And I like all kinds of music. So, like, early on, I would obsess over players, you know, at various stages of my learning. So like Angus would have been the first, but there's plenty of other ones from different genres where I just would go into a rabbit hole on somebody. And yeah, I listen to everything, so I don't necessarily want to paint myself into a corner. And when I make an album or play, I try not to have an intention of this is what I need to fit into. And it's tough because, I mean, lots of people will tell you that. I mean, that's one of the things that's it's tough to have commercial success when you really kind of move around genre wise. And I've seen some of my favorite players suffer from that, and I probably suffer from it too, but for me, that's just kind of like what I like to do. And if I try to start boxing my in and cut off my corners, I'm not going to enjoy it as much, and I don't think it's going to be as authentic. So
I mean, I think this is something that we're seeing more of now. You know, I think we're starting to see a lot more musicians that like that freedom, that like being able to explore these kind of different flavors. I mean, I noticed that you cited Philip Sace as kind of one of your influences. Of course, I spoke with him recently.
Yeah.
And you know, he wanders into that kind of funk road very much so. And, you know, he likes that variety. I mean, there's another chap who's also Canadian, Anthony Gomes. He kind of has his foot in blues. But again, he had that issue of, like, a lot of people had said, well, you know, we want you to just be blues, but he likes doing that wonder, you know, he likes to have that freedom. But, you know, I think we're seeing it more and more now. You know, I think with the ability to kind of do your own thing now. I mean, I noticed obviously with your new album, which Outside the Lines, which is coming out on May 3rd, you mix it yourself. And I believe, don't you play every instrument on this album as well?
Yeah, it's kind of a DIY thing. So yeah, which I like to do. It's kind of my creative process. And yeah, like I say, it's really nice to have control over your own stuff and not necessarily be beholden to a style. And I think in the blues world, that's, I don't know if it's the same in other genres. Maybe I'm just familiar with it because I've kind of been in the blues genre, at least 1 foot in. But yeah, a lot of traditionalists are really protectionist, or really they want to guard the genre as if, like, if you do anything outside the lines, where they're not happy with it. But I don't think, like, the interesting thing to me is, like, great players in that genre, like Albert King or like B.B. King, they weren't doing exactly what came before them. That became the canon of blues, but they were doing their own thing. They weren't just imitating the people before them. And also, I think it's like the cultural milieu, if I can use that word, of the blues guys back then is far different than it would be for me now. So it really wouldn't make sense for me making the same music as they were making back then. So, but yeah, I think that's a pressure that a lot of players who are at least partially in the blues genre feel, that people either want you to stick within narrow lines, otherwise they think you're not real blues, or, you know, that kind of thing. So, so yeah, I've just kind of ignored that a little bit. So before I did this album, I kind of had to think to myself, and I talked to my wife, we had conversations about, should I really just try to redirect myself into blues? Because I've had many people in the industry tell me that, like, look, if you want to get more airplay, if you want to do this, you should really make it. I just can't do it. I can't do just one thing and be narrow. So I just got to kind of put it out there and what it does, right?
I mean, is this a kind of a first for you, where you're playing every instrument on an album? Is it the kind of this thing where you've had this full creative control? Is it a first this time, or have you been down this road before?
My first album, I had my drummer and bass player, Don McDougall and Tom Nagy, were on that album. And the second album, I did everything myself, except for there was a Hammond B3 organ track that I got John Lee to play on. And I didn't mix it. So this time I did it all and mixed it. I didn't master it, which I think is probably why. But yeah, I did it all this time. And part of it, I think, is just being able to get it out into the world in a quick enough way where you don't have to wait. Like, I don't want to wait for when the mixer's available, when the publisher's ready to go, all these different things. And also, it's just a creative, like, I think mixing is a creative element of the process, right? And I really enjoy it. And I spent a lot of time learning how to do it, and I think it turned out pretty well. So, yeah, I really like to do it that way.
I mean, my personal kind of favorites off the album is Ain't Got the Blues, which I believe you just released today on the single, and Attitude, which I think shows that kind of a bit more that rockier side with that riff there. Could you talk a bit about those two songs, how they came about, maybe the meaning behind them?
Yeah, sure. Ain't Got the Blues No More, it was basically about just kind of not conforming to the blues, like we were just talking about. Kind of been a theme through my career, for better or worse, but just not conforming to the blues establishment, which, and there are some great people in the blues establishment, DJs and fans and promoters and festival bookers and stuff, that have open ears and kind of want to spread the wings of the genre a little bit, or allow some other influences in. But basically, that song is just about, you know what, I'm not going to worry about what people who don't get it think. Are blues traditionalists, you know, and I kind of, my mantra has been kind of, if it's not for you, then it's not for you. Right. So there's enough people out there, I think, that will dig it. And the funny thing is, like, when we play at blues festivals, like, it always goes over really well with blues audiences. So I think people just kind of need to give blues listeners a little more credit sometimes. That's kind of what that song's all about. And Attitude is kind of a similar theme of just not really kind of changing yourself for what other people think, you know, kind of going your own way. And there were a few personal situations where I had to deal with some, some people, as we all do, right, that are a little bit, I don't know, I don't want to say backstabby or, you know, that kind of thing. Where you run into people where you just kind of got to cut them loose and say, you know what, it's like, if you don't dig the way I am, then we're done here. So.
No, I get it. Now, of course, I had read that a few years back now, you opened for George Thorogood, which is a bit of a claim to fame there, I think. could you take me through that kind of that moment when you came out to the crowd, that kind of George Thorogood fan base there? And, you know, how did that opportunity first come about?
Well, we had gone, I forget when that was, it might have been 2018, but we'd gone down to the International Blues Challenge in Memphis. And so we got through the semifinals there. And George Thorogood's tour manager had seen me play there at the one club we played. So he stayed in touch. And out of the blue, just said, like, hey, George is in Toronto. We need an opening act for this gig. And would I be interested? And I, you know, of course, I said, hell yes.
Yeah.
And it was at Massey Hall, which, if you're not familiar with, is a really big kind of iconic venue in Toronto. So really a bucket list thing for me as a musician and as a Canadian, too. So, yeah, that was a ton of fun. And their crew was really super nice to us. They were great. And it was wild because I've seen shows in that place before, but it's a little bit different when you're on stage looking out. And the seats are really, it's an old theater, so the seats are small. It's kind of a, like everybody's crammed in, and I think it seats around 3,000. So, but they're right up on you when you get up there on stage. Like, they're way closer than you think it would be. I kind of picture it like it'll be a home plate at a ball game where everyone's far away. Mm-hmm. But they were right up close with you. And, yeah, it was a blast. Like, we were on just such an adrenaline high for that. That I think, like, second song, and I realized, like, I was going to have to start breathing more. I was going to, like, I was gonna run up. So, and it was just a blast. We got such a good reaction from the people there. And we got a standing O at the end of our set.
Right. And,
yeah, we were just on cloud nine after that. So it was such a blast and a great experience. So, although, as I watched a video of me playing at it, online once, and I noticed that I came about like this close from tripping over the monitor behind me.
Oh no, it so, like, could have been disaster.
That would have been terrible. But I was backing up and I was this close getting into it, and I noticed that, like, oh man, I almost, like, if I'd taken two steps more, I would have gone tumbling over. So that might have been a different experience. But hey, it's rock and roll, right? So it was fun.
I mean, to get a standing ovation, I mean, as a support act, I mean, I don't know what it's like over there, but I know the English crowds, where, you know, everybody's obviously there for that main act. They might not know who you are. You know, it's difficult, isn't it? So I think to get that kind of reception is, I mean, that must be the dream, isn't it, in a venue like that as well.
It was cool because you could kind of feel the vibe in the room. Like, when we first got up there, the seats weren't completely full when we first got up there, but it was full by maybe like a third or fourth song. And but after we played our first tune, we came up with a really fast, funky thing that was kind of like, you know, I figured let's just, you know, give it to them hard here.
Yeah.
And yeah, then we had people like hooting and hollering and clapping. A few people were kind of like, didn't really know what to, like, what's going on here. So I kind of felt like a bit of confusion with the crowd maybe or something like that, but overall positive. But then as we went on, they just got really into it. And by the end of it, they were, you know, they were really digging it. So, yeah, and then we got a standing out at the end. And we made it we hit our time within like 30 seconds. So I was glad about that. We didn't want to go over, you know, take off the main act. So, yeah, it was great. It was one of the best live performance experiences of my life, for sure.
Now, I had also, of course, read that you spent a few years abroad. Was it in Dubai? Something like that. It was Dubai, wasn't it? Playing like, what was it, 6 nights a week? I mean,
it was four sets a night, too. Four sets a night. And it was like top 40 stuff, which is in Dubai, that's like everything is top 40, at least back then. So, I kind of got recruited for that by a guy that heard me play in a club in Toronto. And I thought he was like just blowing smoke when he said, I've got this gig in Dubai. Sure. So I said, yeah, okay, sure. Like, and it was like a couple weeks later, we were on the road to Dubai. So it was a great experience, but it did teach me that that's not what I want to do. So, like, playing top 40 tunes, like, we were literally playing like Love Shack by the B-52s and like In the Club by 50 Cent and like, you know, Pink and like all kinds of top 40 stuff at that time. But it was pretty grueling. Like, it was playing for 4 1-hour sets a night, 6 nights a week. And by the end of it, I was just burnt out on music. And when I came back to Canada, I didn't touch my guitar for probably 3 months. Like, I just was, you couldn't even look at it. I was just like, but after that, I just decided, like, man, I used to love doing this. Why am I not doing it? And so I just decided to pick up the guitar and play and let whatever come out. And I kind of rediscovered my love of guitar at that point, and then decided that I'd just do my own thing and go my own direction. But it's kind of your dream when you're starting out. You're like, hey, I'm making a living playing music. And it was great. Like, everything was taken care of. I paid good. I'm in this exotic location and everything. But yeah, it's some kind of a lesson you have to learn. Some people, it works for them and they can do it. It's just not my thing.
No, no, I get it. I mean, I imagine at the very least, it's kind of it's a good way of just gaining experience. I mean, 6 nights a week. I mean, I don't know many musicians that play that often.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, although I mean, there's some interesting experiences over there for sure.
Yeah,
crazy stuff. There was because it was just a crazy mix of people. We had like some Russian. We figured he was in some kind of Russian organized crime guy.
Wow.
Super drunk, he would drink like triple vodkas there at this club, and he would come up and he paid us, was it $500 US to play one song? And we're like, yes. Wow. But we didn't even know the song, but he was too drunk and couldn't tell, so we kind of looked at each other and faked it. it was actually during the second Gulf War that I was over there, I guess.
Right.
Somebody requested some Jimi Hendrix once, and so I said, okay, sure. So I launched into the Star Spangled Banner and not thinking that, like, oh, I'm playing the U.S. National Anthem at the time. And so I was kind of like eyes closed, head thrown back, ripping into this Hendrix thing. And then when I opened my eyes, everybody in the band was looking at me just like horrified. Like, what are you doing? So we quickly kind of wrapped it up when we counted ourselves into a different tune. But so all kinds of weird things happened like that. And, you know, so it was really a fun time, but it was a time that ended. Well, I need a 10 for me, for sure.
After that point, he was chased out of the country very quickly.
Yeah, almost.
I mean, obviously, I watched, you know, quite a few of your live videos. I mean, I think that that's clearly, having seen that, you obviously enjoy doing that. You know, that's your kind of your bread and butter. I can see it. I mean, in particular, a thing that really stood out for me was your cover of Little Wing. I mean, you mentioned Hendrix there. And, you know, that I had a lot of that kind of Stevie Ray feel. I mean, I can see him in the background there on the screen. is that something that you love, like, incorporating into your set, you know, having these kind of nods to your kind of heroes, you know, like a Hendrix or a Stevie Ray?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, those are huge influences for me. I particularly love that tune just because it's got some different chord changes to it that you can really have fun with. And I think there's been a lot of really great players that have kind of put their stamp on that tune. So Jimmy, obviously Stevie, but then like Eric Gales does it. Monty Montgomery, who's a great player here in Texas, does an amazing version. There's lots of great versions of it. So I like to stretch out on that. And I always like to make a nod to my influences and put in little quotes and stuff from them, like sneak little licks in there and stuff. Because it's funny, people that will come up to you after a show and say, like, hey, I heard you do this Eric Johnson thing, or I heard this, you know, Danny Gann thing, whatever. And that's, I always get a kick out of that. So I think as long as you're quoting somebody and not just completely aping them the entire night, then it's kind of artistically sound, whereas I don't like play anything note for note. Solos and stuff, but I will pick out quotes. I think that's just kind of a tradition thing that, you know, you want to pay respects to the people and quote them. But yeah, my bread and butter has been clubs, and it is a really difficult thing sometimes. I get that a lot where people are like, what are you doing playing here?
That was the impression I was getting. I mean, I was reading the comments, and I'm seeing occasionally some comments. There was one you did like a demo for. Was it the company that you're kind of associated with, Fractal?
Yeah.
And I'm reading these comments and people are like, this guy's got some chops. Who is this guy? Like, this guy should be playing like bigger places. So I imagine that you're hearing that quite a bit.
Yeah, it's kind of like a backhanded compliment sometimes when people are like, what the hell are you doing here? It's like, well, you know. But yeah, so I'm working on that. Like, it's a thing where I'm trying to get my name out there. It is really challenging right now to try and break through into the public consciousness, you know what I mean, through social media and stuff. And I think I've probably been guilty of not doing enough promotion and basically doing too much working on the craft itself. And because that's what I love to do, right? And now it seems like there's this thing where it's like the art becomes content, you know what I mean?
Yes.
For the platforms. And so I don't really relish the prospect of being a content creator, right? Like people have told me, like, oh, just start producing videos and making lessons online and stuff. And I've done a little bit of that stuff, which I enjoy sharing, like, you know, my approach to guitar. But it seems like that just becomes your full-time job. Like, you have to make it, you have to constantly churn content out for the algorithm to pick you up. So my plan right now is just to release music more often. I try and get out there. And I'm hoping that, I mean, I've had some progress where I feel like I'm starting to get a little bit more known in various circles. And there's been a few setbacks, which is with COVID and with some other family stuff I had to deal with, that I had to kind of take a break from touring. But I mean, I've been to, you know, been all over Europe and through the UK. Actually, I was there a couple of years ago for a 3-week tour, which I loved. And I hope to get back there.
Yeah.
I'm working on it, but I'm hoping that people, if they dig it, will spread the word, and hopefully I can get out to get more places. So.
Now, a question I always like to finish on and ask every guest. If you could tour with one band or musician from the past and one from the present, who would they be?
Well, and actually play with them, or just sit on the sidelines and watch?
Well, you got a choice. You have the keys to the car. You know, you can, if you're liking what's going on, you can stroll on and do your thing with them.
I think probably from the past, I mean, I would have loved to see Stevie Ray play live for sure, but I think maybe Albert King might have been up there for me too. I would have loved to just have seen that energy, that live thing, because I've heard so many recordings of him live, and I think he's just, for me, is the electric blues. For me, that's like the definition of it, is Albert King. And also, I think it would have been really interesting to just see the cultural time that he was. I mean, he spans a number of decades when he was active, but the cultural situation that he was there, like, you know, I can imagine that period of U.S. history being a black musician touring around, like blues, and what you would have had to deal with, and all that stuff would have been a very interesting thing to witness as well. So, yeah, that would probably be him from the past. I mean, AC/DC would be up there for sure. And then presently, I think probably Scott Henderson is on my bucket list of people I really want to see live. He's number one at this point. And he doesn't really tour in the States. It's always over in Europe. So I think one day I'm just going to have to bite the bullet and like book a trip to Europe, literally just to see Scott Henderson. I'm sure there'll be other things to do in Europe, maybe. Right? But, yeah, there's a few things over there to do. But I think he's just such an incredible musician. Like, his phrasing is just incredible. So. And he seems like a really super cool guy, so I think I would enjoy.
Of course, for those that want to pre-order your new album, Outside the Lines, you can via the link in the description below. And, you know, I'm also aware that obviously you do lessons. You can be anywhere in the world. How do people reach out for you to get a bit of that magic, learn a bit of that guitar magic?
They can contact me. My website is GaryKaneBand.com. So there's a link on there if you want to click. You can easily contact me there, and we can chat.
So I'm here with Ross and James of the Rambling Preachers. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having us. Really, really do appreciate it. Looking forward to it.
Of course, you know, it's the ones to watch for kind of blues acts and blues rock acts. First thing, you know, I like to kind of do is I have a look at how things began for a musician. What was that thing that made you guys kind of want to be a musician? Did you have a moment where it was like, you know, this is what I want to do?
I think from my side, if we're going back to kind of when I started as a musician itself, was probably about 12, 13 years ago. So my best friend from kind of primary school and secondary school, he was a musician. I always pestered him to play the piano. He had a piano in his house. And every time I went around his house, I was like, can we not just like play the piano? I mean, I'd never had anything musical. My family aren't musical. And one day he kind of relented and played, and he showed me a couple of notes, and it kind of just went from there, really. To be fair, to this day, I still can't really play the piano, but he kind of was very good at it. And then I thought, well, do you know what, if I could accompany him on guitar, and then, you know, I just picked it up from there, and one thing led to another, and then learning how to play from that, going to jam nights, meeting more and more musicians, you just kind of start to really get into it. And then you you know, go into a deep dive of guitarists and guitar tones and everything else that comes with it. So, yeah, I think long story short, that's kind of like where my background was to kind of where we are now.
Mm. Yeah, mine's sort of bit different. Obviously, like my dad and your dad have been friends since before I was born. So, like, because
that connection,
which is crazy. obviously, both our parents are massive music lovers, and I was just brought up on listening to that type of thing all the time anyway. So, and then obviously, I'm sure you've heard of the guitarist who used to live in Cornwall called Keith Hills, who used to own a guitar shop. Ragtime player, I think he was. My dad bangs on about him all the time. And then he got me a little guitar off of him when I was really little, and obviously I didn't really play then. And then I think it was similar to James. I just thought a friend had a guitar when I was in school, and and I just thought they looked cool and wanted to play them. And then obviously, like I said, I was massively into music anyway. It was always weird because obviously when you're in school, like the kids are all listening to like pop music and everything else. And then there's like me listening to like Led Zeppelin and ELO and like things like that, which is like, and you're trying to put across what you like, and they're all listening to, what would it have been when I was younger? Oh, I suppose it was like the sort of pop punk age when I was in there. I suppose Green Day and that were just sort of kicking off properly. And yeah, as I was getting older. So it's just sort of that sort of thing. My dad, really, he was always my dad. He was massively into music. He still is now.
I feel everybody has that first band, don't they? That's like, it's like their band. It's, you know, like obviously you've got music that, you know, you get from your parents, if your parents are into similar music, like, as you mentioned, they're Led Zeppelin. But did you guys have a, you know, that kind of first one out the gate that feels like your era? It's like your band now, isn't it?
There's so many, because dad used to listen to so much stuff.
Because I remember there was this kind of, when I was growing up, there was this kind of, you know, I often coined the phrase as kind of the original new wave of classic rock. There was kind of this mini wave. So you had like bands like The Answer were coming through. We saw a bit later, we had Blackstone Cherry. You know, those kind of bands. And for me personally, I always felt that, you know, it was like the Blackstone Cherries were kind of like my band. You know, my dad had the Led Zeppelins and all that, and it's like that was his era, wasn't it? Did you have one in particular, James? I mean, was there one that you were thinking like, this is kind of my thing?
Do you know, it's a bit weird because, again, I probably, when I grew up, it was kind of very much pop centric. And I was kind of a teenager around the, kind of late 2000s, early 2010s. So, you know, it's a bit of a, everything was, Christ, when I was growing up, it was Niles Barkley and Black Eyed Peas and, you know, people like Girls Aloud and who else. So I didn't really listen to it that much. So it's difficult. I mean, once I kind of got into the guitar music, you kind of get more down the rabbit hole. So, you know, bands that, I'd say probably back then I was definitely listening to the older stuff. So Clapton, Dire Straits, Fleetwood Mac, all that kind of stuff. But I think, you know, if it modern band wise, it would definitely be more, I try and push people to introduce them to people like Blackberry Smoke and Lucas Nelson, Rival Sons, and, you know, Jason Isbell. I know obviously Ross is the biggest fanboy of Jason Isbell going. And that kind of, those kind of bands. So I think if we were to go with my band for now, those would be the bands that I'd go for. But I would have to say back in that time, it was definitely difficult for me to choose because I was listening to music that was probably 30, 40 years old at that point. So I don't think there was any band around then that really, guitar-based anyway, that really like grabbed my attention. I always loved people like the Kooks, and, you know, there is kind of some guitar work in it, but it's very more simplified poppy stuff, but I love that music. I think it has still got a great place. People like Feeder as well. Feeder are a great band. But from the, you know, the guitar based stuff that now influences me, I think it was so different back then to what I'm listening to now, it's hard for me to kind of put my finger on it.
For those that kind of aren't familiar with you guys, that are kind of hearing you for the first time now, how would you describe Ramblin' Preachers? You know, obviously we spoke a little bit about, you know, there's some influence there from kind of older bands back in the day. How would you describe?
I'd say we're just trying to do that. I'd say it's hard to, without sounding a bit weird, is we're so influenced by like American rock, and not so much the British rock. So it's like there's such a, which is really weird, because obviously all the British people wanted to sound Americans back in the day, and then all the American wanted to sound British and everything else. But we quite go after that sort of like American-y sort, even tonally, like we're going after a tone that, and a sound that's like very much like Southern rocky. And I think we're just sort of developing more into that sort of like almost like Blackberry Smoky sort of Allman Brothers, like hints of like Eagles and things like that. Like trying to do like that sort of thing. And it's taken a long time to get to that point as well. Like we've obviously messed around for a long time now. So it's like, we're trying to like nail a sound, which is like really ours. I'm massively enjoying Robert John and the Wrecks new stuff as well. I think that's really good. Like, and all that sort of stuff. I just think there's like such a good energy in it. And lyrically as well, it's like super good as well. I've got more and more like into lyrics as I've written more and more songs. And that's something going forward that we really want to start focusing on, like writing the songs around the lyrics and everything else more. Again, I think my infatuation with Jason Isbell's been a big part of that, to be fair. Yeah, because he's just a master songwriter, and sometimes I listen to that stuff and I'm just like, how do you do that? Like, it's just mental, and it's a lot of it's really simple, and I'm like, how do you write such a simple song but have so much depth and make everything hit in such a way that's like massively impactful on someone's life? And I find that super impressive, like a lot. And I know Blackberry Smoke do it a lot as well. There's some really good like morals to their songs, and I really like that in a song, so that's what I go after anyway.
And I have to agree, I think that that's kind of the most kind of impactful stuff, isn't it? It's like you almost, I think that's the beauty and the power of music. You know, you can relate to it even though you've never met the person before.
Yeah, of course.
Like you kind of tie your own experiences to
it's that. Almost like this. It's almost like they're telling the story of how you're feeling, or they're telling a story of your life. And it's like, it's like you, they know you. It's really weird. And then you're like, it's like, you know them and they know you. It's to do that's really, really clever though. Like for me, Jason Isbell does it over and over and over again. And I can listen to songs with that and just stick lyrics on, and I'm just like literally sitting there like blubbering.
So, he almost like with Jason Isbell, you could read the lyrics, and you know, Ross showed me, and you can do it. You literally pull up his lyrics from a song, and even without the music, it's like poetic. It sounds like a poem. You know, you could read that out at just a spoken word open mic night, and people think, wow, that's an incredible poem, and not actually realize that it's a song. So, you know, as Ross said, like the contents of lyrics are a massive part in how we go about putting together our songs. You know, we don't want the lyrics to be cheesy or, you know, this and that, because, and maybe to some people they are, but you know, to us and to the style that we're going for and the style that we listen to, that is very important to us. You know, the lyrics above everything else make or break a song. So it's lyrical content is massive, and as you know, as you said, Ryan, like having a song that resonates with people in a specific moment in time is very, very important. You know, and just because you personally haven't been on that journey that the song's telling you, you might be able to take that song and put it into a different story that you're related to. So it's trying to keep it kind of vague enough to keep people, you know, you have so many different people go, I actually resonate with that, but not so vague that people make it sounds like disingenuous.
Of course, you know, your debut album is, you know, it's just around the corner, Sins and Virtues, which comes out on the March 29th. Yeah. Of course, this being a debut album, what was this like for you guys kind of going into the studio? I mean, I'm aware you've done EPs in the past, but doing a full album, what was that experience like? I mean, it's the beginning of this journey, isn't it?
Yeah. It was really... We learned a lot from it, and there's a lot that we've learned from doing this first album that we're really looking forward to, like, writing more. We're looking forward to that. But for what we've done on this album, like, we're super proud of it. And it was like a lot of things were going wrong, and I think anything that could have gone wrong went wrong. And yeah, it was just one of them. And we finally managed to get it over the line and get it all done. And then the artwork, I think, looks really cool. Mm-hmm. And like just everything like that. Like there's just constant like, oh, do you like this? Like, if I had to show you how many different artworks we done, you'd be like, how did you even?
Mine would be fried.
But musically, I think we hit the point where it's like it shows what we can do, and that was the main thing. It's like I wanted it to sound like we meant like we belonged, if you know what I mean.
I mean, there's definitely a clear overarching identity. You know, I think a lot of bands you have stuff in there, you know, on a debut album that's kind of, some of it drifts, and you know, you don't hear that fully formed sound till later on in your career.
I saw your interview. I was watching your interview the other day with with your friend that you were talking about the Rival Sons albums. You were ranking them, and it's like it's so true. Like every album's got really good songs, but it takes a while to develop. And I think once they started hitting, like, now they've hit... I think Feral Roots is my favourite album. But to, like, get to that point, Hollow Bones, I think, showed promise even to what Feral Roots, I think, was for them. And it's just, like, the growth in that band. Pressure and Time's an awesome album, obviously. But, yeah, like, some bands you really want to stick with and just watch them grow.
Yes, it's like a journey.
Yeah. It's hard to be perfect all the time, because I think a lot of people have to remember that a lot of these people are like, not necessarily an art thing, but a lot of these people are like developed already by there's a lot of other people around them, whereas we're just four guys trying to write some songs, do you know what I mean? We haven't got an army of people around us helping us write them and everything else, so... I mean, like I said, we're really trying to find ourselves at the moment. I think we're on the right track now of what we want to be doing. And I think, like obviously Keep On came out the other day as a single, a couple of weeks ago as a single, like love the chorus in that song, Separate Ways of Love. What else? The next single is what is probably my favorite, because again, it does that thing. What I really tried to do in getting a message across to people was the next single is a song called Keep Doing You, which is about just doing your own thing. And there's no bands in Milton Keynes where we live that are really doing anything like what we sort of do. And we've always been a bit like that. Like we've always just sort of done our own thing and not really cared what other people think. If they like it, they like it. If they don't, they don't. Like, you know, not everybody is everybody's cup of tea. So, I think that's important.
I mean, we kind of touched on it a bit there, but you know, my personal favorites off the album are the opening track Their Separate Ways and Jester, which is a favorite. Could you guys talk a bit about those two songs? You know, how they came about, the meaning behind them?
Separate Ways is actually about an argument with a family member of mine. And then it was basically, we were just living in each other's it's hard to explain. Let me think about this quickly. We basically were just clashing all the time and arguing over and literally everything and anything. And in the end, we ended up parting ways and going and doing different things, which is why the song is called Separate Ways. Mm. And it was like always in favor of the other person. So I'm friends with the other person now again, so it's all good now. But yeah, at that time, it was quite a rough ride and just wanted to go in a different direction and we wanted different things and stuff like that. So, and then Jester is a song I wrote for my wife. So, mm-hmm. I just really, and that took a lot of writing. Like, so I think I rewrote the lyrics to that song about four times, maybe five. The chorus always sounded really good and we developed that song loads. Like, I think the intro on it used to be about 2 minutes long.
Yeah, we definitely, when we first started doing that song was probably nearly twice the length that it is now. Mm-hmm. And it was different bits and the riff at the start was different. And it was actually our old drummer who suggested, he goes, you should do this as a single, because we weren't going to, we were going to choose something else. Mm. And he said, no, you should really do it. And we were like, okay, well, we need to make it more radio friendly. And we also need to kind of change the riff, because what was there before was just not going to cut it, really. So we, Ross and I, sat down one night, literally just thought, right, how can we change this? What can we cut out? You know, let's try and cut some of the fat out. Let's produce it a little bit by ourselves, and then go back, you know, go into the studio and see how it's gone. And to be fair, not a lot has changed from it since then. I think
on the album version, the solo got cut more.
The solo's slightly shorter on the album version, which, to be fair, we've been umming and ahhing about it in the other one. And then we changed producers and all the stems got sent over, and it just ended up staying like that, and it forced the issue. And actually, listening back on it now, we prefer it shorter. It's just a bit more, it kind of keeps the rhythm going, keeps the momentum. And with Separate Ways, just kind of came about through every now and then, you know, you'll listen to something, whether it's on YouTube or you'll go and see a band or, you know, a guitarist to play something, you're like, oh, I like that. And I think I was watching a YouTube video and something came up and I was like, oh, I like that. You know, we could develop that into something. And one thing led to another, and, you know, it ended up being, you know, the first main single to come out for the album. And to be fair, when we do gigs now, it's that encore song, you know, it's just a feel good song to make everyone, you know, leave with a smile on their face. So it's kind of, again, it just happened to fall like that. And with the way it's gone, you know, we're really happy with how they're sounding. Jest has been around for a little while now. And as you said, it's a favorite of so many people, you know, and it's quite special when you play a gig and you see people singing along to your own music. Mm-hmm. Obviously, once you get to a certain size of a band, that's, you know, it becomes the norm. But, you know, as Ross said, we're just four guys trying to make music from Milton Keynes. So when you travel up north 100 miles away and people are singing your songs back to you, it's a pretty incredible feeling. So,
what did you guys feel like when that first started to happen? I mean, that would be a moment surely where you think, you know, like, we're doing something right here. You know, as you say, you know, if you've got a crowd that have, you know, started to take that on board and sing that to you, your own lyrics.
Yeah. I think with that stuff, again, it's like, sometimes even playing, if you're not in, like, say if you've written a song that's really old, like, say if you've got like a really old song in the set and you're just really not vibing it anymore, for example, it's really hard to like connect with what you're trying to say with something you're not necessarily connecting with anyway. And that could just be something to do with a song that's just really old and you just don't feel that way about the song anymore, or the lyrics in it don't mean the same as they used to, or whatever. But yeah, I think it's because when we play that song, because obviously, like I said, it's a song about my wife and stuff like that. So it's something I connect with every single time. And I always feel like if there's people there that are as like a couple, for example, it's really important to sing that one, like really from the heart sort of thing. Mm. And I think that's how you get people to connect with stuff. And it's really cool. Like when you watch a video back of something, because obviously you don't really hear it if you're on stage.
Mm.
And then you'll hear like people going like, I am the jester in the background. Which is really good. Yeah, so that's always really cool. I'm like, wow, people actually like our songs.
Yeah, it is cool. It's very humbling as well, you know, the fact that we've written it and people are now remembering it and actually actively coming out to see us. You know, I'll never forget, I think all of us remember, one of our favourite venues in the UK is the Flying Circus in Newark.
Yeah.
And it's such a wonderful little venue. And we went up there, it's probably about a year ago, maybe a bit longer. And I kid you not, bearing in mind this place is 90, 100 miles from where we live,
it's down the road from me. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. Yeah, it's nice and easy. Yeah. You know, every other person was wearing a Rambling Preachers t-shirt.
Mm.
And we just thought, wow, like, you know, that's such an incredible feeling. I know, again, like the big bands, it becomes the norm, but to us, it genuinely is. It blows our mind because, you know, we've got people that are actively coming out and showing their support for us, and they're not even, you know, 2 minutes down the road. Like, you know, they're a long way from where we are. Mm. And it's you know, like a bit like when people sing your songs back to you, it's very humbling, and I don't think it's anything that we'll ever take for granted. Because it's just not, you know, we'd like to think that we're not those types of people that take that for granted, because, you know, we do genuinely appreciate the love and support that people show us. It's it's a big part of what we do, and the fact that people relate to it and want to come and support us is just a huge thank you to them, really.
Mm. One of the other things that really struck me about the album was from the immediate moment that I put it on, the production sounds great. How did that kind of happen? I mean, it sounds like, you know, I mean, I've listened to quite a lot, like people send me a lot of albums all the time. And I find that a lot of debut albums in particular, you know, even if they've got great songs, sometimes the production lets it down a little bit, you know, maybe like a low budget or something, but, you know, different factors. But it's often, you know, it's a hard thing to get right, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
How long have we got?
We recorded it with a friend of ours, and then we got a message off of Wayne Proctor saying, I've just sort of opened my new studio. We actually went to see Wayne with Ollie. And that was the first time I ever met him, because he was playing with Ollie Brown.
Mm.
Because obviously Wayne doesn't live too far from you neither, does he? And he was like, if you ever need anything recording or any mixing or mastering done, he's like, let me know. And then we'd had a couple of mixes back and it wasn't really working off of our other producer that we was using. Mm. And then Wayne done like one free song for us. Just done like a rough mix of it. And it was already a million times better than what we already had. So in the end we decided to use Wayne, and he really brought them to life, helped with a bit of extra production on it. And he's got like a new studio and stuff. I think his studio is called House of Tone Productions. That's it. And he just invested in loads of money into like a new system and everything else. And I think we were the first band that he'd mixed and mastered in his new studio. So that was really, that's quite an achievement as well.
I think he appreciated us being kind of the guinea pig to that as well, didn't he?
Yeah. So. he really nailed what we were going for, and because he's familiar with that type of music anyway, he really understood what we was trying to do, as well as trying to push us into thinking of things differently. Ollie Brown added the new backing vocals on Jester and stuff, for example.
Mm.
I heard it and I was just like, whoa. Like, it just is completely different to the original, and it's just hits in a different way. The good thing about Wayne is he pushes you out of your comfort zone, which you could, if you can take one way or the other. If you can't handle that type of pressure, it's always going to be really hard. But I always feel like the reason you pay a producer is to help produce you and make the best music you can make. Mm. And whether that's just taking out a couple of bars here and there just to make the song a bit more interesting or keep the energy going, or cut the intros down, because there's so much you have to remember as well within like writing them. You have to remember that people's attention spans are literally like a couple of seconds these days. You've got no time for this, you've got no time for that. Like, this just needs to get in, and then you've got no time to develop. You have to like develop within the song. Yeah. I think I was listening to Talksport the other day, and someone said the average person's attention span of what they listen to a song now is like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
I was like, the Beatles were doing that years ago. I swear.
it's gone full circle. We've gone back. Mad.
It was 3:30. Then it went down to 3 minutes. Now it's 2 minutes. Pretty soon we'll just be playing 15-second reels, and that'll be it. That'll be your song. In radio stations, you'll have to play about 6,000 songs in an hour.
But that's it. Like, another thing is radio play. You know, I think we were looking, I think it's Planet Rock or someone like that. And if there's no vocal within the first 15 seconds or something, then they instantly won't air it. Yeah. So, you know, you may think of this massive, long, amazing, intricate intro to a song, and before it's even had a chance to go, they're like, nope, not playing it. You know, I know people, you know, think, oh, well, why do people reproduce their songs for radio and this and that? And the answer is because, you know,
they're too long.
They're too long. Without doing it, you won't get any radio play, and it is a big factor. Mm. But yeah, you know, as Ross said, when you're with a producer, we're very much in the opinion that producers don't just hit the record button and then hit stop at the end of it. Mm. You know, they are as much of it as you are, because at the end of the day, their name's going on it as well. So they want it to sound as good as it can.
I think there is a sweet spot where, you know, if you push an artist, like, I feel that the best time for like creativity is when you're just outside of that comfort zone, isn't it? When that's where you're at your best, I feel.
Did you hear about, because I'm a massive Dave Cobb fan, so I like his like stuff is super recognizable. Did you read about how Blackberry Smoke's new album was like recorded?
No, I haven't heard.
So I read an interview with Charlie Starr that basically said, he basically made them all go in the studio without knowing any of the songs and just made them play. Like him and Charlie went and wrote, Dave and Charlie sat and wrote a load of songs, and then like the drummer wasn't allowed to play. And I think he said something like Dave's input on it was like, you've been playing together for 26 years, you should know how the songs are going to go. I'm like, sod that. That's not for me.
That's a bit too.
That's
a bit too loose.
Imagine trying to do that. That would be so hard.
So album two. I mean, Ollie might be listening. You know, he'll just throw you in a room.
Yeah. No, I don't want to do that.
Ollie, I swear to God.
A question I was like to finish on. I ask everybody that comes on. If you guys could tour with one band from the past and one band from the present, who would they be? Do you have like a dream people that if you could, you know, you got infinite money, you got infinite whatever.
From the past.
It'd probably be AC/DC, wouldn't it?
AC/DC, AC/DC. Just so you could hear Angus in full swing. Like, I want to stand in front of that Marshall.
Are we going with Bon Scott? ACDC.
Yeah, true. Yeah. ACDC.
Yeah. Although I like Brian Johnson as well. Like, I always found that really mad that they found a singer that sort of nearly sounds the same as the old one.
It's very similar.
Yeah, very similar. But obviously very different at the same time. Just to stand there and hear, my favourite AC/DC song is Thunderstruck. Again, that's a thing from my dad. And just to stand there when it goes, yeah, just to be like, yeah, so good. Da, 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 da. I just want to hear that, like, full chat.
Stage side.
Yeah, be so good.
I mean, another one, to be fair, for me, would maybe be Free. You know, Paul Rodgers is my guitar hero above all else. And I think Paul Rodgers is one of the greatest rock singers of all time and is very underrated in some aspects of life. And, you know, Peter Green as well. But I'd say, yeah, from our thing, I think our general consensus is probably AC/DC, just for the same reason. I just want my face melted off by 20 Marshall.
Yeah. I want to be left in nothing but puddle of goo.
Do you guys have one from today, like a present one? Is there a dream one that, you know, that could be out there now?
There's a few I'd love to play with. Like
Blackberry Smoke is definitely one up there.
Blackberry Smoke I would love to play with. Mm-hmm. I'd love to play with Robert John and the Wreck as well. I'd love to play with Rival Sons as well. Yeah. I think that would be awesome. We saw Rival Sons a couple of years ago, and that was very similar to laying in a puddle of mess by the end of it.
Oh, yeah.
That was an onslaught.
And it was another level.
I'd love to support Jason Isbell, obviously. Lucas Nelson as well. I'd love to support Lucas Nelson. There's so many now. We've got such like a big, wide mix of music.
Mm.
It's really weird because, obviously, I think I've thought it for a little while, but I generally think that not necessarily the really country stuff, but there's a lot of American country over there that's making its way over here, like Luke Combs, Morgan Wallen, and they're all like becoming quite popular over here. Especially like if I'm going out playing open mics and stuff, I play like a lot of like country, more country style songs when I go out play open mic. And people will always come up to me and go, oh, do you know Zach Bryan? Do you know any Luke Combs? Do you know any Morgan Wallen? Or do you know any Tyler Childers? And I'm like, how old are you? Like, how do you know these people? Like, and they're like, yeah, we love all that stuff. And I think it's growing quite a lot. When we went to see, Lucas Nelson the Cup last year, that was just full of people just having and it's such a good time as well to go and listen to stuff like that.
Yeah, and like the demographic there was so wide. People are slightly older that are into that music from when they were younger, but then you've got people that were in their 20s going out, and everyone was just, it was so much fun. Probably the most fun we've ever had at a gig. You know, it's great. And I think there's, my other half was saying, there's a TikTok going around at the moment, and there's like the little breakdown from You Should Probably Leave by Chris Stapleton. That song's been out for a couple of years. It's an amazing song. And so many people in the comments are like, oh my God, this song's amazing. Who does it? Who does it? And it's like, this song's been out for years. It's Chris Stapleton, you know. So again, it's, you know, as Ross said, this whole, you know, the American country style stuff is definitely making its way over here.
I think Taylor Swift's been a good...
it's like a gateway, isn't it?
Yeah, like a vessel for that sort of thing. Because I'd imagine that a lot of them, like, not that I spend a lot of time listening to Taylor Swift or anything.
Oh, he's a Swiftie.
a lot of them artists are in like their related artists sort of thing. So I think that could be a big thing. And obviously, she's like one of the biggest selling artists in the world at the moment. Like they literally have to raffle tickets off or whatever to.
I know.
It's like Ed Sheeran as well, though, isn't it? It's that whole one man and acoustic thing. You know, you're into that Ed Sheeran, and you know, love him or hate him, I find Ed Sheeran a bit like the Beatles. He's hard not to enjoy because the music is so
harmless.
Yeah, you know, you can't find fault with it. And I think, you know, if you like Ed Sheeran, then you get down the rabbit hole of Luke Combs and Chris Stapleton, and then it opens up your Tyler Childers and your Zach Bryans, and then you're way down the American country rabbit hole. And, you know, these people are now coming over and they're touring and they're selling out shows. And every time they come back, the gig, like Robert John and the Wreck, they came over last year and they were doing kind of smaller venues. And then their next tour, when they come over, is like so they're just, it's just going like that, and all that type of music is definitely becoming the new like in fashion thing to listen to.
It definitely is. I mean, I remember when I first spoke with Robert John from Robert John and the Wreck, and they had about 7,000 followers when I first spoke with them. They're now at 42,000.
Yeah.
And that's in 2 years?
Yeah.
And they're now, they're coming from the States and selling out European tours.
Yeah.
And as you said, like just the way it's shooting up, especially for them. I mean, they're a great, great band.
Mm. Great live band.
Bands are really, and Henry James, their guitarist, is a phenomenal player. They're all great musicians, but he's a standout guitarist. And, as you said, like every time you speak to them or see them, they're next on the pecking order. And then, eventually they're going to hit the heights of Blackberry Smoke and people like that, where they're going to be coming over and selling out, 5,000 cap venues.
Well, thank you very much for you guys joining me. And of course, for those out there that want to grab the debut album, you can pre-order the Ramblin' Preacher's debut, Sins and Virtues, via the link in the description below. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us, Ryan.
Thank you.